Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Charlotte, North Carolina, this is Friday, January 31st, 2014, the last day in January. And I'm Michael Lawson here with Thomas Fortenberry.
Happy New Year to you, sir.
Yes.
It's been a very interesting start to the year.
Very interesting start. We have so much. I have at least 35 hours of stuff that I could do today.
Yeah. That's just pre-recorded.
And
not even stuff that is just happening. I mean, that's not even we're not even talking about the president and his speech this
I'm
week.
I'm not even going to talk about the president today, right? Because I can't even get anything in with all this other stuff that's happening here. And remember, the greater the power, the more dangerous the abuse.
Edmund Burke. That's a very good line.
That's a great line.
It's one of those power corrupts absolutely kind of thoughts.
And we're going to have a young lady in about 10 minutes calling in.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Judge Sherry Beasley. And Judge Beasley is a judge on the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Supreme Court. Now let's go.
Supreme Court.
I bet they're going to have a busy docket in the next couple of years once all these lawsuits start drifting through from the our new 1860s legislature.
You
that we got.
Think? You think?
I bet that's why they want to change this.
And Sherry Beasley is one of the, if not the first, I think she is the
first
female black Supreme Court judge in the state of North Kakalaki.
Another historic moment.
Another historic moment. But, you know, we're going to have a lot of historic moments because, you know, it's always historic when we have Chris Christie.
There was nobody on my staff who had any knowledge of this issue until after the issue was already done.
Really owes you money. Do you think it's an unusual arrangement that you're uncomfortable with now?
No, not at all, because I know the way the office operates, and I don't get any heads up on anything, the same way we didn't give heads up to people when I was there. I'm embarrassed and humiliated.
So, you know, it's just unbelievable. Then he goes on.
No contact with David Wildstein in a long time. A long time, well before the election. You know, I could probably count on one hand the number of conversations I've had with David since he worked at the Port Authority. I did not interact with David. If David would be here for a meeting in the State House and I ran into him, we'd say hello, how's your family, we'd chat. We didn't have that kind of relationship. Just.
And you know, it's getting so bad. They already have the emails. They have the emails from Chris Christie, from his assistant chief of staff, Bridget, dear old Bridget.
Yeah, but you also...
Who he fired and never asked what... He's a prosecutor.
Yeah.
How do you know not ask the first question? Well, with me the first, did you do it? And then you say, yes, I did it, okay. And then the prosecutor's next question is, why? Isn't it? Why?
Right.
He said, when he had the no, I never asked her. Well, why should I ask her?
Yeah, I don't know anything about what, huh? I just randomly.
Is that called plausible deniability?
I just randomly.
Or is that just, I don't have to ask you because I know why. And I'm throwing you under the bus.
Yeah, that would be the reason.
But I'll take care of you.
The speed bump.
Well, now that there is a federal prosecutor, he can't help her. And here's the other thing.
Well, and unfortunately, unless he really set that up with a nice sweet pot, he can't help himself either if she decides to protect herself.
Here's another thing. Last night on Rachel Maddow, unbelievable story. And it's another example. By the way, the story I'm going to tell you about is, and I'm not going to tell you the whole thing because we're going to talk about it in length next week.
Right.
But the New Jersey governor has more power than any other governor in the state in this country.
Really? I know that like a lot of them, like Texas, are really weak. But, New Jersey has actually
power. About weak. He has more power than Cuomo. He has more power than any other guy. Because, you know, in New Jersey, you don't appoint the attorney general. I mean, you don't elect the attorney general. You appoint him.
How convenient.
You don't appoint you don't elect sheriffs. You appoint him.
It's like a thugocracy.
And
so all your friends and associates get in there.
There aren't many
well, see,
jobs that normal people would run for that aren't appointee jobs.
Right.
Jersey.
Well, I heard that that's what had messed up, you know, the board authorities, that they started appointing outright cronies when used to it was supposed to be.
Yeah, but this just has been like this.
Fairness,
it's been like this since 1876. They've never changed it because they're so corrupt. Everybody, Democrats and Republicans.
But see, it keeps you from launching things like investigations.
And that's what I'm going to get to. It seems that the ASPCA in Jersey doesn't answer to anybody.
Really?
The ASPCA in Jersey is an armed force. The ASPCA in Jersey.
So kind of like the armed garbage.
This one area,
truck guys,
this one place in Jersey, and I said we're going to talk about it next week, where the head of the ASPCA ordered over 65,000 rounds of ammunition.
What?
For long-nose sniper rifles, 40-caliber guns, bulletproof vests.
For what? They have really bad
matchstick
problem?
Tasers. When someone, and they were appointing people in their own, appointing people to go out, and they were wearing badges. Not only were they wearing badges, they had uniforms made up that looked just like state police. It was a state police uniform. The only thing they were supposed to do was put an ASPCA badge on it, on their sleeve. But only one or two did.
Right. Oops. Yeah, how convenient, right?
And they used to go to people's houses
and intimidate them.
When they had complaints with dogs, they would stop people on the street and tell people you're driving too fast. They would do it. So finally, somebody in ASPCA got upset about this and called or sent an anonymous wire to, wasn't anonymous, well, it was anonymous at first, to the state's, to the FBI. FBI came in, did a whole lot of evaluation and whatnot, and indicted the head of the ASPCA. The head of the ASPCA, they found all this ammunition. They didn't find all 65,000 rounds of it. When they indicted him, they indicted him, he told one of his friends, don't worry about it. The attorney general, the governor, the attorney general will take care of that. I'm sorry, it was the governor, because Christie was governor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The governor will take care of it.
Currently.
When the indictment came down, he was indicted by this state's attorney general.
Right.
Or assistant. What happened then was the next day, this attorney general who pleaded the case to the jury was removed. The attorney general for the state came and told the judge he no longer wants to press the case. And the judge, without any qualms, dropped the case.
You see how that works?
It's
almost like
the judge
different justices.
Was a Christie
appointee.
The attorney general was a Christie appointee.
And so was Mr. Brownshirt.
2 years later, there's this, in another county just next to it, a female sheriff was appointed by the governor. And within 6 months, every person that worked at the ASPCA was now real authority to arrest you.
Isn't that funny how that works? And see, this is the thing that cracks me up about these guys. They always complain about big government and the abuses of government and all that. When, you know, there's a hint of any liberal in the room. There's nothing bigger than that.
Well, the man that prosecuted this case didn't see all. It's come to find out that all these people had worked in the attorney general's office when Christie was the attorney, was the U.S. attorney's office. They worked in the U.S. attorney's office.
Yeah. So
when he was U.S. attorney.
A cabal. That's what.
And this woman, who was a sheriff, never asked these people to fill out paperwork, never asked these people to do for a background check. One of them was a child molester. The FBI found out about.
See? Yeah.
She was relieved and is now being prosecuted by the FBI. The new U.S. attorney is now looking into this case because they all worked for Chris Christie, and the case was squashed. They want to know how it was squashed. It could only be squashed from
the governor's office. Direct from on high.
All right.
Right. Now, look.
So this is another thing they're looking at.
Yeah, this investigation is just expanding. And once they turn over, you know, one rock and 10 rocks, it's just going to wipe Christie out. But here's what you got to hope if you're Chris Christie.
Oh.
Just like, you know, that other dick that we know, Cheney.
Oh, yeah.
Your plausible deniability, your get-out-of-jail-free card, okay, is only as good as your little scooter. And if your underlings are willing to take the fall, 110%, destroy all evidence, do everything possible, lie, cheat, steal, and go to prison for you, he may be safe. But if anybody decides, you know what, I don't want to spend my life in jail while Christie's out in the golf course and playing around, and they turn on him, then he's done. I mean, that's his only hope, is that everybody falls at his feet and goes to jail for him and saves him. Because he's smart enough, dude, that you know he's destroyed evidence. He's told them to destroy evidence. He's done everything possible. And his only hope is that they all do that and
his
fall on their sword. And they all go to prison or whatever.
Fall on their sword.
Otherwise, the king goes down. But we'll talk about that next week, right?
We're going to talk about that next week. And it's just that's a fascinating story. If any more shoes don't drop.
Like both hogs.
Now, there was so much that happened. Did you hear about the school in Utah?
Yeah, that's one of the things I was going to mention when we were talking about, you know, I was going to mention it when we got to the billionaires, how they're now pretending to be victims. You know, how they want to be the Jews of the Holocaust, they say, because they just, you know, cry their crocodile golden tears and say, you can't possibly think bad of us. You know, but there's this weird culture of greed in this country where your only value as a human being, your absolute only value, and this comes from, there's a strain of, you know, economics in the 1800s that this comes out of. But anyway, there's a strain that says your only value is your monetary value. And what your entire human profile is, you know, what job did you do? Your worth is your career and money. And what you do as a career is what you get paid, and that's it. That's your only worth. And we see that in action in Utah. The thing in Utah was so disgusting and horrible to me that it infuriated me beyond belief. I couldn't believe it. When you take children, not only do you bar poor children from even being able to eat because their parents, you know, owe $10 at the cafeteria or whatever, but you go beyond that, and it's a complete bullying that they took their lunches from them in front of the classmates, in front of the school, and dump them in the garbage can, and then make them sit.
They did
give
them a little milk and an orange.
You know what? Look.
So they had their protein and they had their fruit.
Yeah, well, you know, give them a pack of ketchup and they can have vegetables, right? But this is just the rich are now trying to say that they're the victims in this country, that everybody hates the 1%, and that, Tom Perkins, that billionaire eventually count the capitalist, that we're like the Jews in the Holocaust. I mean, it's just so insulting, right?
It's just like
so
Kristallnacht all over.
Yeah, we have these guys that they would rather, because their parents owe $2 to the cafeteria or something, you go and take
a
child's hand
because it was over a month. It wasn't $2. It was like $8.
It's ridiculous, Mike. I mean, you're victimizing and bullying children. You're embarrassing them
in front of their
and you're taking their food away. And this is food, by the way, it's already on the tree, so they had to throw it in the garbage can. It wasn't like they just refused to let them go to the cafeteria or something. No, they throw their food in the garbage can.
Oh, but we can't. Once we serve it to them, we can't give it to anybody else.
Yeah.
But they do beforehand.
Yes. And, you know, they still did it just to make an example. So, you know, it's the whole point, to humiliate them and to bully them and to embarrass them so bad that their parents, you know, would be forced to pay the, you know, back lunch due. I mean, come on.
If you had a zero balance or a negative balance, you didn't get anything.
Pathetic.
Throw it away right in front of all the kids.
Pathetic.
Bam.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that is victimization.
We're going to get back to this, but right now we have a young lady that Governor Bev Perdue,
who, by the way, was the first female governor of this state, and she did history with this lady.
That's right, who selected to fill the position of Justice Patricia Goodson as in North Carolina Supreme Court Judge Sherry Beasley on the phone with us. It is an honor, Your Honor.
Hi, it's good to see to be with you all today.
And did you hear a little bit what we were talking about in Utah where they threw out the kids' food in the garbage because they had a zero or negative balance in their account?
I heard the tail end of that conversation, and I've certainly seen some of that on the news.
I mean, this is, and then everybody acts like, oh, gee, that's a mistake?
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's valuing money over children. Their entire worth, basically, is do you have $5 in your account or not? And that's just, it's dehuman. It's horrible.
And so that leads me into your position. Well, how have you enjoyed your first run at the Supreme Court?
I'm sorry, how has the what run at the Supreme Court?
You enjoyed your first run at the Supreme Court.
You know, it's an interesting time. This is my fourth election. You know that I served on the district court bench in Cumberland County, Fayetteville, for 10 years and presided in criminal and civil. I was a family court judge and a certified juvenile court judge. And in those 10 years, I ran successfully twice. And then in 2008, I ran successfully statewide to the North Carolina Court of Appeals, served there for 4 years. And now this is my fourth election, again statewide, to retain the seat on the Supreme Court. And the really great news is that people really want to know. It's kind of difficult keeping up with judges and making distinctions between local judges and who the judges on the Court of Appeals are and those on the Supreme Court and what it is we do. And so much of what I find myself doing as I travel across the state is really helping people understand the differences and also why it's so important that everybody care about who's serving on the Supreme Court of North Carolina. Because whether people know it or not, everybody knows who the president is and who our senators and congresspeople are and who our state legislators are. But a lot of people really don't know that the decisions that we make at the state Supreme Court really do affect everybody's everyday lives. And so it's really important that people know that we have good justices there and those who are experienced and really understand and are willing to apply the rule of law fairly.
Well, everybody doesn't understand. They know who the president is.
They might know the governor.
And they might know the governor, but I guarantee you 90% don't know who their senator is. And talk about judges, they don't know how to spell the word judge. And I'll tell you, I'm being quite frank. Supreme Court judge, all they know is Clarence Thomas. That's all they know. They don't know there's a North Carolina Supreme Court. All they know is there's a U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
It really is tough sort of getting that word out there because judges sort of have very different election rules. And, you know, often there's not the same level. There is never the same level of publicity for other elected positions as for judge. And so it really is difficult to get the word out. And so I'm glad to have the opportunity to be here today to talk with you all and also to help people understand who I am, what my service has been about, and why it's so important for them not only to know my name, but there are 4 seats up on the Supreme Court this time, 4 out of 7 seats. That's a lot of seats. And so it's going to be quite an election season for all the seats on the Supreme Court, as well as, of course, other offices across the state.
See, I didn't even know that. It was four seats. I thought there was two, but I didn't know four. But see, here's a problem I have, and it's called the dumbing down of our children, our next generation, because they don't teach civics anymore. No, that they do one of those cursory things. Unless you have a real energetic and resourceful teacher, you're not going to know about the history, the histrionics of,
right,
of judges and how it's elected. Judges play four, even in the Supreme Court, play more important in our lives than the President of the United States would ever fill. Because they expect us every single day, especially the district court judges. Now, what does the Supreme Court judge do?
So, generally speaking, most cases start either in the district or superior courts, and every county or judicial district has superior court and district court judges. And generally speaking, and there are some exceptions to this rule, generally speaking, cases can be appealed from either district or superior court to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. And then cases can be appealed from that court to the Supreme Court of North Carolina. So let's just say A sues B about some issue, and it makes it to the Supreme Court of North Carolina. Well, certainly the outcome of that case affects Party A and Party B. But since we are a policymaking court, whatever happens in that case becomes the rule of law for all kinds of cases that are similar to that for everybody in North Carolina. And that's why it's important for people to know that those decisions really do affect every one of us.
Well, you know, you said a word that is very troubling. You said policy making. And these right-wing conservatives are saying no judiciary body should make policy. They need to follow the law, the Constitution. So what?
Well, it is true that we must follow the rule of law and apply the Constitution as was intended fairly. What happens is often when there is either a conflict in the law or some uncertainty in the law, or where, let's say, maybe a statute isn't quite as clear as we had hoped, then the courts are called upon to step in to interpret the laws that were made by the legislature. And so to that extent, we are, in interpreting the rule of law, it really does set the policy for all of us as North Carolinians.
Well, you know, it's just like the Second Amendment. I mean, every time Dick and Harry has an opinion about what helps the Second Amendment, you know, but I read it as it says, with a militia, with a legal militia. It doesn't say anything about you as a private citizen with your own private means. So, but yet it's been interpreted as anybody. So, people say, well, you make your own policy and you're not following the law.
Well, you know, often we can all think about laws as they're written, or the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, the North Carolina Constitution as they're written. But it's really not until we find ourselves in a real-life situation that we give those laws or the Constitution some context. And so it's easy for us to say, this is what it says, unless we have a set of facts to go with it. And that's when it's important for the courts to step in, because it's when we give those laws or the Constitution a context or a set of circumstances in which to have it applied fairly, that the courts need to step in to make sure that the laws are interpreted fairly and fairly applied to everyone.
Well, when does the Supreme Court, or does the Supreme Court, or can the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, trump North Carolina?
When does the U.S. Supreme Court trump North Carolina?
Yeah.
The North Carolina Supreme Court provides what we call precedent, or when it decides the cases, then the North Carolina Supreme Court is bound by all decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court. So we cannot make decisions which are contrary to those decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay, but I understand that. But when would the federal court come in and override a decision made by the state court?
So cases can be appealed from the Supreme Court of North Carolina directly to the United States Supreme Court when, generally speaking, there are some exceptions to this, when there is a U.S. constitutional issue. Now, you have to know that there are cases coming from all over the country appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and so it is within the U.S. Supreme Court's discretion as to which cases to take. And often what happens is when there are several courts across the country who are either misinterpreting the law or interpreting it so differently that the U.S. Supreme Court feels that it needs to speak, that's often a time when it will accept an appeal or several appeals on a particular issue in order to try to make sure that everybody's on the same page, if you will.
Right. So that would be like a example, like if a state passed a constitutional amendment barring certain couple of scenarios or blocking access to health care or something like that.
And let's say that's happening in several states across
right.
the country. And those cases, if there are state issues, might be appealed for those state issues to the state Supreme Courts across the country. And then, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think that's a great example, the U.S. Supreme Court could then hear those issues knowing that in some way the country needs clarity.
Okay. And then just to ask for our listeners, since we were talking about, I mean, one of the things that I love that you hear about is simple education for civilians. This is absolutely the purpose of what we need more citizens to understand. So for the Supreme Court, is it open or is it closed? Is there a way that common citizens in North Carolina can observe your day-to-day cases? Can they watch TV? Can they listen to it on the radio live? Or is there some kind of way, a website, something like that, that they can share in the experience and or comment or talk with you?
That's a really great question. The Supreme Court of North Carolina sits in Raleigh, and all courts, with very few exceptions, in North Carolina are open to the public. And so if there's a case of particular interest to your listeners, they can find out when it's scheduled, and they can actually come to the courtroom and listen as a citizen of North Carolina. They have every right to do that. Generally speaking, there are times when cameras are allowed in the courtroom with permission of the court. But generally, the news stations, and there's only one feed and several news outlets, generally speaking, will feed into that one feed. But the news stations don't usually air the whole court session. They'll usually air segments of it, and they'll usually air segments of cases which they think will be of great interest to the public. But that's how. But the courts are open, and your local courts are open. There are some cases when a judge may use his or her discretion to close a court for some, maybe there's some sensitive information being discussed during the court session or whatever the case might be. But the rule of law in North Carolina is that our courts are open to the public.
Have y'all seen a change this year, given the dynamic change in governor and the legislature of North Carolina? And have you seen a change in the coming, like, court
docket with all cases coming in? Is there an influx of cases? Is there worry about law? Is there more requests to interpret law? Or you know, what's happening on y'all's level?
I think as a society, people tend to be. We went through a phase where people were less likely to go to court, and then we went to a phase where people were much more likely to go to court and became much more litigious, if you will. You know, where going to court seemed to be the way to handle a lot of issues. Now what a lot of folks are finding is where cases can be settled through mediation, which means there is an impartial third party who comes in and sort of hears from both sides and gets input from both sides and helps them to come to a resolution that each of them feels comfortable with. A lot of people are going that route, and a lot of parties are going that route. A lot of businesses are going that route. But, you know, in the very same way that there are some hot-button issues that people feel very strongly about, there is a lot of talk about there being litigation about them. And so while those kinds of cases haven't made their way up to our court at this point, they certainly very well may be, depending on whether or not there are federal or state issues involved and how the parties decide to proceed on those. So, you know, it's hard to say at this point. It does take a little while to get to the Supreme Court. And so it will be interesting to see, you know, just how where we are in this state and in this nation will determine what kind of cases we will hear in the future.
And caller just on the line, who's calling in, I'll be with you in just a minute. There's two questions, additional questions that you are judging. One is, have you noticed a change? Because you are a female judge in your position since this change in atmosphere, North Carolina?
Let me say, first of all, I have always been a female judge.
Yes, you're right. I'm sorry.
I know exactly what you're saying. I get it.
Are there other... female judges.
He's talking about the political climate has changed. So.
Yeah. Are there any female judges on the beside you?
Out of the seven justices on the Supreme Court, four of the seven are women.
Oh, see now, very liberal.
Just a question real quick. How many of the four, other than yourself, are part of the four that are going to be up for election?
One other in addition to me. Now, our Chief Justice, Sarah Parker, will retire this year, and so her seat is up, but she won't run again.
Right. Oh,
so
here's a question about that. How do y'all choose that? Do you do it inside, or is it an appointment?
The governor?
Is the governor, does he have the power to appoint the Supreme Court Justice?
No, the Chief Justice is elected by the people. So in order to serve as Chief Justice, you have to run for the position of Chief Justice.
Does it typically come from within the court, though? Would one of y'all have to run for that seat?
Any lawyer who's licensed to practice may run for Chief Justice.
Wow, okay. So that could be a profound change, right?
Absolutely. Well, the Chair of Parker from Mecklenburg County.
I'm sorry?
Sarah Parker is here in Mecklenburg County. So,
she's one of our natives.
Yeah.
Yes, she is from Mecklenburg. That's correct.
She's been there a long time.
Yeah. Well, this is a...
How is it being a black woman on the Supreme Court?
You know, I think it's an important perspective. Out of the seven justices, I am the only African-American, period. And in the court's nearly 200-year history, there have been seven women and five African-Americans. You know, and certainly as our state and our nation becomes more multicultural, I think it's important to have the perspective. And so I've been honored to serve. I think my voice is a needed one. And I think it's important that for so many reasons. I think it's important that I'm serving there as an African American woman, and those two factors, in addition to all my other experiences, serving as a judge and as a lawyer and as a person. But I also think that every person who comes to the table at the Supreme Court comes to the table with his or her own experiences. And that's why I think it's important that we have a diverse bench, because, when we don't have shared experiences, we often find ourselves in a position to enlighten one another. And I just think that's hugely important. If all these cases could be solved by looking at a book and determining what the answer is without giving some acknowledgement to real-life experiences, we would be at a huge loss.
Well, I want to get back to that question, but right now we have a call. Hello, caller. Who's this on the line? Hello? I guess we just want to listen. The thing is that what I wanted to get back to is, and what you just mentioned, has it becoming more difficult, or is it more difficult to take the law as it is written? And since you are interpreting the law, to interpret the law with your own self-worth, how you interpret the law, or you're interpreting the law the way you think Thomas Jefferson would have interpreted the law.
Well, these are very different times. for more reasons than just the fact that he and I are probably hugely divergent people. But I mean, these are very different times, and
we have representatives right now that say we can't. It's got to be the exact same way as the founding fathers said.
You know, I think a well-grounded interpretation of the law and of the U.S. and state constitutions must be grounded in the rule of law. And so, as I'm contemplating these very important decisions, it's not what Sherry Beasley thinks. It is, what does the U.S. Supreme Court say about this? What does the statute that's involved say? What do our rules say about it? What are all the applicable pieces of the law? And what is the fact situation before me for me to make a decision based on the rule of law about the case before me?
Mike, I think it's very important. I mean, I think what you said earlier, one thing about taking the rule of law as, set in stone rule of law, I'm a person that believes in living law. It adapts over time. We are not the same era as the founding fathers, because back then, we had slavery and stuff like that. It was the law. I mean, so things have to change over time to begin with. And B, I don't care about what a law says. If it was just literally a literal interpretation of words on paper, you could just have a computer running a, printout, here's your decision. You have to have some kind of human experience, some kind of compassion to look at things and to be able to interpret the situation. And that's why I think it's absolutely essential, what you said earlier, to have women, to have minorities, to have diversity as much as is reflected in our society on the court.
But according to the right wing, that's not true. What they're saying is a judge should be nothing but a parliamentarian.
No, I understand what they're saying, but it's
yes.
And I think that, like for instance, having one, there was a case recently of a lawmaker who said that there should be no health care for women doctors, for women that are 50, because their uteruses and all that are useless after that. They cease to function. You remember that, right? Wanted that stricken out of the law.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, it would be a good thing. Say that was, say then that his law became fact, that was the law. You get no health care because you're a woman, you know, after this. Well, it would help to have a female judge to say, hey, guy without the uterus, hey, come here.
Right.
You know, and at least have that experience to bring. And that's why it's so important to have someone who is a mother, someone who is a minority, someone who is, you know, XYZ, to be able to bring that experience. So that you can interpret things fairly and correctly. It might be blank. I mean, even though it's supposed to be different, I realize that. I'm just saying,
yeah.
You have to have the human in there. It can't just be, you know, impartial hatred of everything that isn't written in stone.
Have you found that, well, what you're doing now in the Supreme Court, is that much different than the appellate court?
I'm so grateful that I had the experience at the Court of Appeals and really at the district court level as well. I mean, it's really the district court that, you know, day to day really faces parties and witnesses and folks face to face every single day solving everyday problems. The work at the Supreme Court is different. The experience of the Court of Appeals was hugely helpful, and it is wonderful to have been able to build upon that experience. But the work is different. We hear and receive often cases that are appealed from the Court of Appeals, but by the time they get to us, the our perspective is somewhat different because the Court of Appeals addresses the party's issues, and they may have a far-reaching effect as well, especially if the Supreme Court doesn't speak to those issues. But the way that we address them is very different, and so. You know, it's been a, I mean, it's an honorable experience, to be, tasked with, making sure that the rule of law is fairly applied. And it's an awesome task. It really is.
Now I understand there's been some changes in how judges can collect money to run for office.
When I ran for the Court of Appeals in 2008, we had public financing, which meant that I could raise X amount of money, and then after I raised that threshold, I could receive an additional amount of funds that were actually paid by the members of the North Carolina State Bar into a fund. And every candidate will receive that once they reach that, raise that threshold amount of money. Now that public financing option is no longer, so that, you know, it's expensive running a statewide race, and I am raising money from across the state of North Carolina to run an effective race, so that people know who I am, understand what my experience is at the District Court of Appeals and Supreme Court levels, and helping them to understand who I am as a person. You know, and the race will be very expensive without that public financing component.
Now, see, and for the people who don't understand, public financing, that's not money that I give or Joe Clover. That's money that you and other lawyers ante up, put into a fund.
Yes.
And
when the practical effect of that, though, have a, it's a chilling effect on anybody that doesn't already have a pot of gold.
If you don't, you know, that would disable common citizens ever being able to run for a
venture. Yeah, only venture capitalists could run.
Right.
Well, and the other thing that we know will happen is that these races will likely be, some of them will garner some support from some special interest groups where they are giving who knows how much money to support candidates. And, there's a lot of commentary about that right now among members of the bar about how we need to be careful about how we select judges and how we need to make sure that the process of selecting judges and justices has an ethical basis and is grounded in integrity. I mean, that's just so important. And we need to make sure that even when folks are not influenced by the money, that it doesn't even – there's not even an appearance of impropriety where those funds are considered.
Well, speaking of the Koch brothers, do you see a already, or y'all just worried about it? But is there an influx of outside money, because they've been well known for doing that in other states, going in and flooding races on a local level and basically kind of tainting or buying an election and skewing the results?
Well, the filing period is from February 10th to February 28th, and so it's a little early to know just how that's going to pan out at this point.
It's never early to collect funds to run.
I'm sorry?
But the thing, what I was saying is that it's never early to ask for money to run. Never too early to ask for money to run. But, see, here's the thing. What this effect actually does, it kills the process for minority women, minorities, period, to run for office. Anyone before. Well, you know, it, even if you are a lawyer.
It is... one of the largest challenges candidates will face, and it's very real, and it ought not be that way. I mean, who is successful in these elections ought not have anything to do with money.
Exactly. And also, you know, the side effect is you spend all of your time having to raise money instead of, you know, studying or being a better lawyer or doing whatever you need to do, bettering yourself as a human being. Instead, you're running around having to chase money all day long.
And wasn't that the reason why one of the reasons they gave why judges should be non-affiliated and not a one party or the next, because you didn't want them to be tainted by money and owned by one affiliate or another?
At least in part, and that party affiliation ought not affect a judge's viability in a campaign, nor determine what his or her thought processes might be in making decisions. That was the premise behind us becoming nonpartisan.
Well, it don't seem to be working now.
But maybe that's something.
Has anybody come to your August body and said that I want to challenge this?
I'm sorry, talk to who?
And has anybody come to the Supreme Court yet challenging this new
change?
No.
No.
Does anybody know about it besides us today? Well, maybe we ought to get to the Charlotte Observer and pitch them a little.
Yeah.
Because this is completely outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, you might as well not be unaffiliated and might as well be affiliated if they're going to do this.
Maybe we can start putting logos on the robes.
Right. You know? Maybe, yes.
Works for Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well,
Your Honor, since we're talking money, now seems to be an appropriate time. Could we ask how a citizen of North Carolina could help you run for re-election? You have a website, you have a phone number. What can you let the citizens know?
I do have a website, and it is Justice Sherry, C-H-E-R-I, Beasley, BEASLEY.com. And there's contact information on there. There is a place on there where people can make contributions, of course, which I'm hugely thankful for. And we also have a Facebook page, which is also Justice Sherry Beasley. We'd be glad to see you there as well. I think it's a hugely important and exciting time for folks to get involved. These races are hugely important. And so I would encourage folks who really care about this state, and I know that your listeners do, and I know that your listeners care about the judiciary, and now that they understand, if they had any questions about what it is we do and why it's so important, that they will get involved. I hope that they will support me. I hope they'll go to the website, again, Justice Sherry, C-H-E-R-I-B-E-A-S-L-E-Y.com, and check me out, make a contribution, go to the Facebook page, Justice Sherry Beasley, and there's also a place there that they can volunteer and be a part of the campaign as we work really hard to be successful this year.
There is the State Executive Committee meeting for the Democratic Party being held in Charlotte, North Carolina, Center, tomorrow at 9 o'clock. You don't have to be an SEC member. Any person, Democrat, Republican, alien, Martian, can attend. And Justice Beasley will be there. You can ask her questions. Of course, she'll come there to talk to you. And you can find out more from her. And I'm going to be there. We're looking very much to see you live. And get some more thoughts.
By the way, I'd like to urge anybody listening, you cannot underestimate the help that you give as a volunteer.
Right.
I know you think it might be worthless or a waste of time. It is not. People need help. They need help everywhere. And they need help at all different levels. So please do volunteer. It is substantial help.
And now, the one other thing before you go, I mean, since they now don't let you have a public financing and you have to act like a regular old legislator and go out every day and beg for money, I mean, has this changed the way you take time and looking over cases? I mean, it's now cutting time into the way you look at a case, doesn't it? I mean, how many cases do you look at?
Well, I mean, trust me, I'm going to get my work done, but it does. I mean, it takes a lot of time to talk with folks, help them to understand why this is so important, and to encourage them to make contributions. It takes a lot of time to do that. I'm sincere. Sincerely honored when people are willing to support me at any level, and certainly when they're willing to make contributions to my campaign to show that they have faith and confidence in my ability to continue serving at the Supreme Court. It is one of the greatest compliments and honors anybody could ever show. So I'm always very grateful about that, and so I don't complain about it. This is where we are, and the fact that I'm serving, especially given the history of service on the Supreme Court, is amazingly huge. So every single day I thank God for allowing me to be where I am. And I get my work done. I work hard to raise money and to run this campaign ethically and with integrity and to continue my service to the people of North Carolina. That's a lot to be thankful for.
That's a whole lot to be thankful for.
Awesome, though.
There was another question I want to ask you, but I'm going to save that for tomorrow when I ask you. But I want to thank you so much. It is always an honor to speak to you in person or on the phone. And we hope that you go get it.
Yep. I hope that you continue. One of seven. The only one of seven.
That's right.
Continue making history.
Now, we only have, would you say there's seven on the Supreme Court or nine on the North Carolina Supreme Court?
Seven on the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Is that supposed to be, is that the top, or is it supposed to be nine?
No, there's supposed to be seven. There are nine on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay. Well, one other thing before you go, have you run into Judge Wynn lately?
I have, and he is doing well.
Well, you give him my regards.
I will do that. I'm sure he'll be really thrilled to know that you asked about him. Gentlemen, thank you so, so very much for having me today. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to speak with each of you as well as to your listeners.
Thank you very much.
Y'all take care.
See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. And that was
the Honorable
Sherry Beasley, North Carolina.
How amazing.
Now, there was just some breaking
justice.
News about Chris Christie.
Well, that's part of the investigation.
Michael Isikoff is coming out with it. We're just going to go back here and see what this breaking news is. So I can read some about Weinstein.
He knew.
Let's see what it says here.
But this is not news, Michael. We know he knew.
We know he knew, huh? Okay, the breaking news.
It's just that the breaking news might be they have proof.
Well, that will be it. It says that Weinstein says Christie knew about lane closures.
Right.
Well, is he a vampire or is he not a vampire? How many stakes need to go in? Well, it's got to go in the heart, though.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I think he's had a lot of stakes over the years.
Now
we're going to pound in some wooden stakes.
And remember what Christie said. This is what Christie said.
There was nobody on my staff who had any knowledge of this issue until after the issue was already done.
And well, Weinstein, this is what he said about Weinstein.
No contact with David Weinstein in a long time. A long time. Well before the election. You know, I could probably count on one hand the number of conversations I've had with David since he worked at the Port Authority. I did not interact with David. If David would be here for a meeting in the State House and I ran into him, we'd say hello, how's your family, we'd chat. We didn't have that kind of relationship. Just...
You remember those years that the GOP loved to do this all the time, but do you remember when Bush was under investigation and they were talking about bringing down the whole White House?
Right.
And they had the logs. They got the logs that the people were in the White House meeting with others. And he was like, I don't remember. There are a lot of people.
Who's the gay reporter? He said,
there are a lot of tour groups that came through. Maybe he was on a tour group, right?
Well, the guy, now they were talking about that newspaper reporter that was gay, right?
It's just, I mean, it's just like this, though. I don't, Weinstein, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, well you got to remember. Remember the picture.
A long time ago.
They had a picture out with David Weinstein.
With him laughing it up with
the head of the chairman of the Port Authority.
Yep.
That was the third day into the lane closure.
Yeah.
So how did he not know?
Hey, they were probably laughing about the lane closure.
They were laughing about the lane closure. David Sampson was there with him. Now, Weinstein don't look like he's fit to go to prison.
Yeah. Well, Weinstein might be cooperating, as they say. You know, that's what
cooperating.
I said this earlier. The guy is only as safe as his weakest underling, okay? And as soon as somebody decides, I'm not taking the fall for you, they're going to turn on him, and then he's going down. But if they're all willing to scooter themselves, they'll all go to prison.
As Don Corleone said, "We're going to, the U.S. attorney is going to make an offer you can't refuse."
It looks like a horse.
If it smells like a horse.
And if it's laying in your bed when you wake up.
If your bed bleeding, it's a horse.
It's an offer you can't refuse.
You can't refuse. I mean, drip, 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 drip.
But you know what this means?
This means
we're going to have a lot stronger contender in Ayn Rand Jr. I mean,
in Ayn Rand Jr. Oh,
Rand Paul Jr. Because you know he's been looking for a way back in because he wants desperately to be president, and he kept getting overshadowed by these more I don't want to say large personalities, but you know what I mean, boisterous people like Christie. So now he might be back on top, or somebody.
Well,
like that.
You know, there was this article about the pressure that's mounting for this development in Hoboken. For people who don't remember,
Hoboken,
the mayor of Fort Lee,
term.
The mayor of Fort Lee, mm-hmm. was crucified because his whole, all of Fort Lee was tied up with 70,000 cars inundating the city as normal, but with no release point because they couldn't back up because the cars were behind them. They couldn't go forward because the lane was closed.
Mm-hmm.
So kids, little kids, one-year-olds were going to the bathroom on the bus in their pants because they were sitting on the bus for 5 hours.
And they had the one old lady who actually...
The old lady had a heart attack. She died.
Yeah.
She died. Because the emergency service vehicle couldn't get through the crowds because there wasn't even, they couldn't get on the sidewalks to drive down. Then we go over and we find out about Hoboken with Mayor Don Zimmer, where she was made an offer that she shouldn't have, not could refuse, shouldn't have refused, but she says, forget it. I'm refusing it. What's he going to do, break my leg? Well, that hasn't come yet. But anyway, the thing is that Dawn Zimmer was told by the lieutenant governor, now, in a parking lot outside.
Wait, I think I saw this episode of CSI.
You saw the episode of CSI? She was told by the lieutenant governor, Guadagnino, Neo, whatever it is.
Some of those mafioso names are so hard to pronounce.
Well, please, that, hey, I know this isn't right. I know it's not right. But if you want that Sandy money, you got to give in to this Rockefeller group to buy this one, to be the ones that take over this $1.1 billion complex that included a 40-story tower, office tower, 300 condominiums, and parking for 1,400 cars. Now,
let me just back up one second. I want to make 2 points. One, for our listeners, that Sandy money, we're talking about Hurricane Sandy.
Federal.
And this is the
money.
Disaster relief money that
yes.
was flowing around at the time. Okay, so that's that. And then just to give a little bit of history real quick, what we're talking about is there is a group called Rockefeller, but there's a group that came in with the Christie administration. They bought up abandoned, old, horrible, forsaken property in Hoboken that in this article I'm reading, it says it was littered with old broken factories, bus lots, all this stuff, property that had been zoned as the worst of the low-end industrial sites, that type of stuff. So they came in and bought it all up because someone happened to notice that this old part of town had a stunning view of Manhattan.
Duh.
Right across the river.
Duh.
So they came in and made a, and it's still, by the way, completely secret, but they made a secret proposal to zone and buy all of this property at stunningly cheap prices from the Christie administration. Now, this is the backdrop for that.
Right.
Continue on. So
well,
at this complex, it's going to be a $1.1 billion.
Right.
So they bought up some old, you know, weedy lots.
Right. The thing about it is that Mayor Don Zimmerman had another offer that was less expensive, and that the to build the structure there, was more expensive, and that they were told by Lieutenant Governor came and told her that, I know you got better offers, but you just got to let this group do the deal.
Yeah, you're going with this group.
Now, the Rockefeller Center,
pay more,
the Rockefeller Center, a national developer, began prowling Hoboken for construction sites in 2007. This is the same company that built Rockefeller Center, but has not had a relationship with the Rockefeller family since the late 1980s.
Right.
So they're using that.
The name.
They're using the name.
Because they got cachet.
That's right. So when Don Adams said, you got to be kidding me. You know, I said, well, let me think about it. And she thought about it. And she says, I am not going to be intimidated. Now, there's more breaking news. I just missed it on here. Well, Wallstein is talking. I mean, what's going on here?
That's what's happening. He's talking. That's
so
exactly.
Wallstein has evidence Christie knew about the link closures.
You're only as strong as your weakest link, people.
I'm telling
you. Somebody's not going to prison.
And the weakest link, you know what the real weakest link is going to be? It's going to be one of those staples that Christie used to shrink his stomach.
Mm.
Because after he put that 200th cookie in his stomach and burst those links or staples. Don Zimmer said,
what?
Ms. Zimmer kept the developer and the lobbyists at arm's length, saying she did not want to deal with a single project before she had conducted a planning study for the entire North End.
Right.
But there was never any money in the city budget for the study. And if the Rockefeller Group could not gain much traction with local officials, they were doing better with the Corzine administration.
Right.
Well, you know, Corzine, he was all crooked too. Everybody's crooked in Jersey.
Yeah. 2009. Did you see this thing about the very next mayor, Camerano, served for 31 days before the feds removed him.
Okay, right, absolutely. The thing is that in 2009, the state's Economic Development Authority approved reimbursing Rockefeller Group up to $750,000 for the removal of contaminated soil and underground storage tanks and monitoring the groundwater contamination. Efforts on the state level accelerated after the election of Mr. Christie as governor in 2009. Mr. Christie, like most governors, had been eager for new developments in New Jersey. He also is close to David Sampson and a Wolf and Sampson founder whom the governor would name as the chairman of the Port Authority. And it just so happens that he represents the Rockefeller Group who wants the contract to build this project.
And see, part of the problem was, all along, it's not just that you award it to one construction company or not, but you also have to grease all those approvals. You have to change zoning. You have to change all these different things. And that takes, putting people in place, we'll say. You have to have the right people in the right places so that all these things can occur.
Now, slow progress went on, and the Rockefeller groups went after. Then we got Zimmer said, I have tried, after she wrote a letter to Mr. Christie.
Mm-hmm. But you got to understand, and put this in context, that Zimmer was the lady who went in after the dude was
indicted
and removed.
Right.
So the guy who was trying to race all this through got caught taking bribes only 30 days into office and got removed by the FBI. So it wasn't like he kind of, sort of, didn't work out. No, he got caught in criminal activity, got removed. This new lady came in, Zimmer, said that she was bringing a sea change to Hoboken and wasn't going to do that. That's why she was keeping things at arm's length of the lobbyists and all that. And she was opening transparency to the citizens again.
That's correct.
And they said, that ain't the way we do things around here. And that, I love this quote. Thomas Newman said, part of the machine-style politics of the past is making deals with developers. So they were going, what are you doing, Zimmer? Right? That's why things
now,
messed up.
It says, by the mayor's accounting, the pressure really began last spring. In an April email, Hoboken's planning lawyer wrote that Mr. Sampson, the chairman of the Port Authority, who was put in place by Chris Christie, Rory Ruffa, a lobbyist from his firm, and a former member of Mr. Christie's cabinet. I mean,
so you know,
you keep your friends close, but your enemies closer? Okay.
Yes,
wanted to meet with him. The planning lawyer wrote that he was getting the full court press on this. Later that month, Hoboken officials discovered that Ms. Graffa was going to be in attendance at a May 9th meeting in Trenton about flooding. If this is a meeting between the city and the state, please explain what role Lori Graffa has in it. Stephen Marks wrote in an email to one of Ms. Graffa's colleagues at Wolf and Sampson, which is, again, the authority's chief, David Sampson's law firm. Wolf and Sampson and Lori Graffa categorically denied Mayor Zimmer's allegations relating to this firm's role in the Rockefeller Group's redevelopment project. The day before that meeting, May 8th, Ms. Zimmer wrote her letter to Mr. Christie, I have tried to assure Hoboken residents that Hoboken would be treated fairly because you have always treated Hoboken fairly in the past. That was also the day that the planning board met to vote on whether to accept the redevelopment study. As it turned out, Rockefeller might have inadvertently hurt its own bottom line. The planner who did the study, Michael Sullivan, told the board that after the demolition, two of the three Rockefeller blocks would no longer qualify as redevelopment property under New Jersey guidelines. With that, the planning board voted to designate the entire North End allowing for much smaller tax breaks. So now they wanted to go in because they thought sure they had it, and they're not going to give all these people tax breaks.
Right.
They're now going to give them little tax breaks.
And you see what is going on. Again, even when they're ramming things through and then the law catches them on something, a little technicality that they didn't foresee, they just circumvent the whole thing by rezoning entire region, you know,
well, that's
everything
what they
up there. You know,
so the Rockefeller said that the decision made no difference. The zoning change it needed was still possible.
Right. But the whole thing here, like when Zimmer is saying that the administration, the Christie administration, tied her prospects for Hoboken getting any aid,
that's right,
for disaster relief aid, to her direct appetite for development.
That's right.
She either did everything they said,
or
she got nothing.
Right.
You know, that's the way it is. Now, the governor's like, oh, no, we never said that.
Yeah, well, it's the conversation between Ms. Zimmer and Guadago occurred the following Monday. She said Ms. Zimmer's version of their talk is not only false, but is illogical.
Oh, illogical. Hey, playing the Spock card. What?
Oh, yes. Completely playing the Spock card.
I like it when those guys use big words like illogical. Yeah, you know what? Here's one for you. Illegal. There's another one. Sounds similar, has worse consequences.
Ms. Zimmer also alleges that in a separate meeting in December, Mr. Frazin linked Hoboken's prospects for receiving aid to her appetite for development, as you just said.
Yep.
Privately, Representative Rockefeller Group said they were taken aback by the mayor's accusations, especially after their cooperation with the city on flood planning.
Yeah. What I love, though, is that they try to just say it's just all innocent, nothing's going on. Like they had the one guy, Mr. Reed, the governor's spokesperson, he said, you know, it's common practice for all the members of the administration to be jointly meeting with officials.
Oh, absolutely.
The hurricane-impacted communities, and we're just, you know, trying to help out and do things, you know. But that ain't what's going on.
Is it ever what's going on?
You know,
and
greasing
when,
the wheels
when
for private
is
companies.
Enough,
is that a,
when is enough enough? When is enough enough?
Hey,
now,
there's not enough greed in the world, Mike.
Now,
we need some more.
When billionaire venture capitalists and billionaire venture capitalists are saying now that we're being picked on by the 99% and 44%.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's just insulting.
Well, but you see, you know,
then you start
we're people too.
Yeah.
We're people too. We're just like the Supreme Court said.
Our poor little billionaires. Now
we have poor billionaires too.
Under the Holocaust.
We have poor billionaires that have to sell their third and fourth boat too, because they didn't make it. Now
here's
a guy.
Card. This Tim Draper guy.
Oh,
this venture capitalist. I just want to read this one part. So he said, Schadenfreude. Something that continues to be a thorn in humanity's side. That's what they're suffering. And he said, this is my favorite one because it sounds so elegant. The bitter taste of envy brings us all down. So see 99% as you shuffle along in the gutter, you're just envious.
Not only
as we drive by in the limousine. See, and that's all it's about. You're just envious. You're just a loser, and you want to persecute the poor, innocent.
Well, Tom Perkins had this to say about being a poor billionaire.
Do you regret this? Do you regret this?
Yes. I talked to the head of the Anti-Defamation League, Abe Foxman, this morning, following up on a letter I had sent over the weekend apologizing for the use of the word Kristallnacht. It was a terrible word to have chosen. I, like many, have tried to understand the 20th century and the incomprehensible evil of the Holocaust. It can't be explained. Even to try to explain it is questionable. It's wrong. It's evil. Now, I use the word because during the Occupy of San Francisco by the Occupy Wall Street crowd, they broke the windows in the Wells Fargo Bank. They marched up to our automobile strip on Van Ness Avenue and broke all the windows in all the luxury car dealerships. And I saw that. I remember that the police just stood by frozen. And I thought, well, this is how Kristallnacht began. So that word was in my mind. But I don't necessarily need to read from this letter, but if you're interested, I can.
Sure, go ahead.
I deeply apologize. This is a letter I wrote to the Anti-Defamation League. I deeply apologize to you and any who have mistaken my reference to Kristallnacht as a sign of overt or latent anti-Semitism. This is not the case. My late partner, Eugene Kleiner, fled Hitler from Austria and fought in the U.S. Army. We became the deepest of friends during our long association, and he taught me, quote, never imagine that the unimaginable cannot become real. He was never comfortable with the extreme political currents in America and never took our freedom from demonization for granted. I believe that he would have understood my Wall Street Journal letter and would have agreed with the warning. And then I apologize for using Kristallnacht, as I just said before. And I had a pleasant discussion with Abe Foxman just before I came here, and I hope that at least that part is put to rest.
So more than 90 Jews were killed in Kristallnacht, 30,000 people put in concentration camps.
Right.
What were you going for?
The Jews were only 1% of the German population. Most Germans had never met a Jew, and yet Hitler was able to demonize the Jews, and Kristallnacht was one of the earlier manifestations, but there had been others before it. And then, of course, we know about the evil of the Holocaust. I guess my point was that when you start to use hatred against a minority, it can get out of control. I think that was my thought. And now that, as a messenger, I've been thoroughly killed by everybody, at least read the message, you know?
You mentioned the word hatred.
Yes.
Do you feel threatened?
I don't feel personally threatened, but I think that a very important part of America, namely the creative 1%, are threatened. I'm friends with Al Gore, who tells me that inequality is the number one problem in America. I'm friends with Jerry Brown. I voted for him. I will vote for him, even though he raised my taxes 30%. He tells me the number one problem in America is inequality. And that's probably and possibly true, and I think President Obama is going to make that point tomorrow night. But the 1% are not causing the inequality. They are the job creators. I mean, Silicon Valley is, I think Kleiner Perkins itself over the years has created pretty close to 1 million jobs, and we're still doing it. It's absurd to demonize the rich for being rich and for doing what the rich do, which is get richer by creating opportunity for others.
How do you feel threatened?
Well, I said I didn't feel personally threatened. I feel, however, that as a class, I think we are beginning to engage in class warfare. I think the rich as a class are threatened through higher taxes, higher regulation, and so forth. And so that is my message.
If this is the kind of persecution that is happening to the 1%,
yes,
what's happening to the 99%?
I think the 99%, I mean, I did not come originally from the 1%. I grew up as one of the 99%ers. And so I'm your classical self-made man, if you will. I think the 99% is struggling, and really struggling, to get along in America. I mean, we have ever-increasing regulation, higher costs, I think, caused by more government than we need. Small business, it's difficult to form and prosper in a small business these days. It's difficult to hire. And that, in my view, is what is hurting and causing, hurting the 99% and causing the inequality. So I think that the solution is less interference, lower taxes, let the rich do what the rich do, which is get richer, but along the way, they bring everybody else with them when the system is working.
Now, you are a multimillionaire.
No, I'm not a billionaire. I'm
You're
a multimillionaire.
I said multimillionaire.
I've created some billionaires, but I unfortunately am not one.
You have owned fancy yachts, fancy cars, an underwater submersible.
Airplane. Underwater airplane.
I saw it. It's basically an airplane that flies underwater.
Right.
Do you worry at all that you are divorced from reality? Are you divorced from reality?
I don't know if anybody can answer that truthfully. I don't think so. I give and have given and will give millions and millions of dollars to a long list of charities. I have in mind some more chairs at universities to give. I still want to leave my children something that they can have, even though upon my death the government will take about 45%. So, yeah, I think I'm connected to reality. I've got lots and lots of friends that are younger and in this whole web-based, Twitter-based world. And I think I know what they're thinking and talking about, yes.
What about Silicon Valley? Is Silicon Valley, to a certain extent, divorced from reality? You have kids. You mentioned you created billionaires. You have kids making six-figure salaries, getting free perks at technology companies, taking shuttles with Wi-Fi access down to the peninsula, which regular residents don't have access to. Is there something to be said for this idea that Silicon Valley really is living in its own little bubble?
Yeah, I think there's something in that. On the other hand, it's a bubble that has created, that has changed the world, has created incredible wealth, you know, around America and around the world. And maybe you have to put up with a little techno-geek arrogance in order to get the results of those sort of folks thinking.
How do you see this divide playing out?
Well, now that as the messenger I've been shot, I think at least read the message. And
but you just said at the beginning of this that you regret
regret the use of that word. It was a terrible misjudgment. I don't regret the message at all. In fact,
what is the message?
The message is any time the majority starts to demonize a minority, no matter what it is, it's wrong and dangerous, and no good ever comes from it.
What's the solution?
First, to understand the problem, be aware of it. That's why I wrote the letter. And I don't apologize for writing the letter. I should not have used that awful word. But the letter said what I believed. And I believe we have to be careful that we don't demonize anybody, and that we certainly don't demonize the most creative part of our society.
Now, is this guy full of crap, or is he not full of crap? What the fracking thing is wrong with this guy?
Oh, man.
Demonize me. Oh, you saw that commercial. Don't hate me because I'm gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Who is demonizing them?
I know. And I love, by the way, he's not a billionaire, sadly. He's just a multimillionaire.
But he has stuff that billionaires only dream about having. He has an underwater airplane.
Well, he has an
airplane. That's a submarine.
And a submersible. That's just insane.
I mean, it's like I saw something in the, what was that, I forgot what the name of that movie where he had the...
James Bond? Is that the one?
Yeah, well, that was one, but the car was a submersible. This guy's got a plane that he said was a submersible.
That was just insane. Look, he's got, I think, divorce from reality was a term that was floated around in there. I thought that was good.
She was a good interviewer.
I like that she didn't let him get off the hook.
No.
He kept saying, you know, well, maybe I shouldn't have used the term that I mean what I said. You know, what
did
you say?
Look, that,
I mean,
you know, they always said they're parsing that. Well, it's just a word I use.
No, it's not. He just compared the billionaires to the Jews being exterminated.
He compared the Occupy Wall Street as the Nazis during Kristallnacht.
Well, look. Besides all the fact that it's completely, utterly different, let's just also point out that Nazis were fascists.
you think?
It was the, you know, capitalist class. So anyway, and this whole crocodile tears thing about it, I'm a victim because I'm the 1% and
I you know, I'm the minority, and I love how, you know, they say, oh, people shouldn't ever do anything against minorities. Really? Just coming through a month of remembering MLK and fixing to get into Black History Month, you're really going to go there? You know, you're really going to pull that one out and say, let's remember to love minorities. I mean, come on, dude.
I mean,
he's got everything.
But he's talking about minorities as in rich. Not
now, that's the thing.
Poor.
Having everything going for them. They have
everything.
Power,
and
they
now
have,
they're being persecuted.
Yeah, that's the thing. And what he says that bothers me is the crying, all I wanted to do was leave a little bit for my children. You know, dude, even if you had to pay the full horrific penalizing 45% taxes on, you know, your inheritance tax and stuff, you're leaving hundreds of millions of dollars anyway to people. So I don't want to hear about how hard it is. The whole point of the estate tax and taxing the rich and all that kind of stuff is that when you extract and sit on your golden hoard like a dragon, you know, you don't contribute to the society. You don't contribute to the overall economy. But when you're forced, death, to reinvest half of your savings into the economy, it helps keep the economy growing and booming and the next generation to flourish. It allows new people to come in. Otherwise, you get a landed aristocracy like they had in Europe. That's what we went away from. That was called feudalism. You know, that's why everybody had a big castle.
And
your name was all that mattered, because 17 generations ago, somebody built the castle, and that's all the people that can live in it. And everybody else just works the ditch around it. You know what I mean? Come on.
And you think that's something?
That's not a victim. Feudalism had some victims. They were called serfs, not the masters and lords.
Oh, I understand. Serfs, that's what you call them.
Yeah. I'll show you an example. A multi-billionaire, not a victim, right? You want to know a victim? A victim is a child, an innocent child who's done nothing. He isn't old enough to work or do anything or no better. You know, he's not an adult. He can't be responsible
legally. Like the kid
had
the lunch thrown out.
But when their daddy didn't give $5 to the lunch fund and they get their tray taken away and dumped in the garbage can and told to go sit in the corner and cry and hope you're not too hungry and, by the way, do your work, you stupid kid. That's a victim. A victim isn't a guy with a submersible that has to pay taxes.
Michael, we're bigger than U.S. Steel.
These are individuals.
Yep.
And they're bigger than U.S. Steel. Matter of fact, I don't think U.S. Steel's in business anymore, are they? These are venture capitalists who made money, who never brought a daggone thing to the table, but made money on other people's money. They did. They go in, not bringing anything with them, and they leave with nothing also, because what they have is funny money. It's not real dollar bills. It's funny money.
Well, he obviously didn't learn the lesson, because, you know, even he said, hey, I haven't always been mega rich. I was born part of the 99%, you know, in a condescending way. And then I ascended in, like a god.
Yeah, I ascended. I like that.
But
I ascended.
The point that you missed the point then, because, like, take his children that he, you know, I would just like to leave a little for my children. Okay. If they grow up from the cradle with a few hundred million sitting there, that affords them some comfort. You know, they don't really have to race out and starve and get a job at 14 and all that, because, you know, they don't have lunch money and they can't own new clothes and everything else unless they go, you know, work somewhere sweeping and, you know, summer. And they didn't have to work their way up to anything. They're already toward the 1% at birth. They've already got connections. Because, you know, when you have money, you know, things happen.
But the problem is,
you know, people give you things and people want to work with you because you're a multimillionaire already.
What do these kids
do?
So
what do they work into?
What do these kids do? The kids of these venture capitalists, do they have any kids? Because they're not bringing any dynamic to their kids about building a wooden bench, about hitting a baseball. They bring no knowledge to them. They give them no knowledge. They just give them money to now go out, because you come from a rich family, to now go out and own things, but you bring no knowledge to the game.
Right.
You don't come home every day and sit down with the kid and say, well, I was sweating today because I had to build this,
yeah, but that's,
this bridge.
That's when you get these, you know, the long-standing old joke about the, you know, the playboy or the whatever, the person who is just grown up with money, never does anything, and just sits around partying all the time, because they don't value it. They don't have, there's been no struggle in their life. They don't understand. They can't comprehend working for a living and acquiring something, which this guy said he did, you know, giving kudos for, he made money.
Right.
But the next generation is supposed to make money, too. They can't just sit around on the estate of the Lord and enjoy the parties every day. You know, that was, you know, didn't we see recently DiCaprio just redid?
Yes.
We talked about the 20s, the roaring 20s, you know.
Right.
What comes after that is called a crash.
The Wolf of Wall Street?
Well, yeah, I was even going further back than that, but that's okay, too.
Now,
Great Gatsby, my man.
Well, the Great Gatsby, too, but see, what he's doing, also, this guy is, there's more breaking news up here about Chris Christie. Okay, we just heard it. Okay, it's a news about news about Lenny. Okay,
breaking news. He's going to.
Well,
so.
now this guy and Draper, they feel. Is this trying to call the person that brings you that the news that he's the bearer of bad news, and you blame the person that brings you the news. What I'm saying is he has a capacity that I don't even think is reasonable in life. How, when he has every single thing he can ever imagine in life, no one can take that from him. I don't care how much taxes you put on him, you still couldn't take it from him.
Yeah, but that's why, look, we see it all the time, you know, the joke of pop culture and TV and stuff. You have this whole generation of people who are famous because they're rich, like the Paris Hiltons and the Kardashians and everything else. What do they do? Everybody, that's always the joke. What have they ever done? You know, now they own some businesses and stuff because they've, you know, accumulated more wealth on TV. But they didn't do anything. They were just simply rich.
Yeah. Let's go
except for
hear this. Hello, caller. Who's on the phone? Hello? Okay. Well, the caller just wants to wait. Hold on. Come back to you, caller. I will come back.
That was the caller from before, I guess.
Well, no, it's different caller.
I'm just listening.
But see, now... What this guy now? His name is Tom Perkins, right? And he's a venture capitalist. Do we know what he's a venture capitalist in? Well, or does it matter what a venture capitalist is in?
It doesn't matter. All they do.
It doesn't matter.
They you know, channel money and people. Like you said, he's made billionaires, but sadly, isn't one.
isn't that terrible?
You know, it's just like standing in the flow of money and directing it here and there.
Right. Well, he goes to work every day and just brings his credit card with him because he doesn't bring a lunchbox. He doesn't bring he has his limo driver bring him to work. He's not building anything because at the end of the day, he never uses his own money. He uses other people's money, but he actually doesn't have money. He has it on paper,
right?
And it's a commodity that he doesn't see on an ongoing basis because it's only paper. And it's just like that clown in New York, Ted, not Ted, but Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump doesn't have money. That's the reason why he did not want to run.
Every 6 years, I mean,
that's why he did not want to run for office, because he would have to give out, just like Lawrence O'Donnell said, he would have to reveal what he has.
All right. Right.
And he only has one paper.
Well, everything he does is this shell game, and it's all the spin.
That's right.
It's all, and that's why he's so good. Now, the one thing I give him, because, you know, he certainly can't master his hair, and he certainly hasn't mastered his finances, because he literally does declare bankruptcy every day.
That's true.
The one thing he has mastered, and he's become very good at, and other people like the Kardashians have mastered, and others, is that he has branded himself so that it survives no matter what, because he's just always selling himself.
That's right.
That's why everything's got a T on it. It's all Trump this, Trump that, whatever. It's all, it's me, ego, ego, ego. But again, these are people who are kind of empty in a way. All they do is stand around in the flow of money and direct it hither and yon and influence things and control things just by being there. You know, like all these guys on Wall Street, they're just, the thing that cracks me up about Wall Street is they don't actually do anything. You know, they just sell imaginary things.
Now, I worked on Wall Street for like 7 years. So
right.
We did do something. We had
But you're selling imaginary things.
3 hour lunches.
Yes, but you just sell imaginary worths, shares,
right,
of things back and forth amongst people.
That's right.
And make money from it.
And what's wrong with that?
Yes, but it's just the creation of nothing and the selling of nothing.
The creation of nothing and the selling of nothing.
Yeah, and it's just you're sitting there going, ha, ha, ha. And, you know, it, to me, they just, you know, it, you know, someone who does something is like someone who goes and does heavy construction that really builds something, or a teacher who constructs a mind and builds a human being from the ground up. You know, these are types of people who are actually doing something tangible. Whereas
you mean like Rush Limbaugh?
Someone that just says, you know, this week we decided that the share is worth 12.5, and next week it's worth 13.5. Woohoo! You know.
Well, are you telling me like Rush Limbaugh does? He creates minds.
Well, he actually,
and it is
very,
a terrible thing.
Very influential. I will give him this. He is a major part of the buying and selling of most narcotics. Well, some narcotics, but no, I mean, he hasn't been arrested lately. I kid.
He has
I
not
kid.
Been arrested lately.
But yeah, there's a. But again, that's just buffoonery. I don't want to talk about him. What bothers me though about this guy is that he, as he said, he wasn't even. He's not apologetic about whatever he said and all that. It's only the way he said it.
The way he
just,
said it.
He said, everything was good, just I used the wrong word.
No.
No, you didn't. Everything you said was wrong. And the fact that you were so comfortable in using that word in that way, it's kind of like, you know, the N-word and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And people say, well, how come we can't say it now? Aren't we over that? And all that kind of, the ignorance is so frightening to me. Because the whole point of, and, you know, I love his defense. Why do a Jew? He was my friend.
Yes,
you know,
he
I mean,
was
I,
my
that
friend.
Really, you know, did you really just say, you know, some of my best friends are Jews, so it's okay. You know.
But he said that. He said that the man that helped him start this whole thing, Kleiner, was a Jew.
Yeah, and even that, he's using some guys. That, you know, he
right.
He say, like, I got 10 Jewish friends right now. They're
right.
Standing right here beside me. Because he's the guy's dead, and I think he would have approved.
I,
okay,
because
okay.
He's dead.
So, because he's dead, he can't
that's
defend
right.
himself.
Because
so that's
dead.
Another insult. But anyway, beyond that, it just it is so insidious and insulting the way they just will use things and the way they feel victimhood. And they're the 1%.
But it's the same
like
thing.
Saying, oh, woe is me, I'm the king. You don't know how hard it is.
No, Obama's
I own
the
everything
king. You can't be king.
I control everything. And, oh, the stress of having to control and own everything is so hard.
It's
and
so
you
hard.
And your poor life, you don't have anything to worry about but your own little straw shack. You know, you've got it so easy.
Well,
that's
the thing what the guy said. It's hard out here being a pimp.
Yeah.
So, you know, hey, right now, we need to take a different tack, and we are going to –
Or even half the tax.
Half the tax. And we're going to speak to the chairman of the North Carolina Democratic Party, who's having a big party in Charlotte this week. Matter of fact, tomorrow.
Ooh.
Mr. Randy Vola. How are you, Mr. Chairman?
I'm doing great, I'm Michael. Doing how are you doing?
I'm getting a couple now with a cold and getting nasally, and it's
hey, but, welcome to winter, Mike.
Yeah, welcome to winter. So how are things going for the SEC for tomorrow?
Well, I know we're going to have, there's a couple of breakfasts that are being held tomorrow. One by the African American Caucus that Willie Fleming and Dr. Robbie Heary are going to be hosting along with others, and then I think the Young Democrats, and we're going to have our Executive Council meeting, and then the SEC meeting, and then the Sanford Hunt Fry dinner. So it should be a full day.
Uh-huh. And, you know, before, I don't think you had a chance to listen. We had Judge Sherry Beasley on because she's running
mm-hmm.
again. And shocked to hear that this regressive Republican House and Senate has killed public financing portion that helps judges. It mainly, I think, really helps minorities who are judges who are running, and they can't use any of that public financing now, and that is going to hurt women and all minorities running for office.
I agree. It's essentially certain elements of the extreme GOP agenda is to cut off all public financing and then claim it's wasteful and then try to say money is free speech, which they got the Roberts Court to do with Citizens United. But the truth of it is, if we just, you know, the FCC allows people to license the airwaves. If we just said, look, give everybody equal access, allow them to get their message out, you could cut down on a lot of money in these campaigns. But, you know, I think hell will freeze over before that will happen.
Well,
excuse
my
French.
That's very sad.
Well,
I'm the school. I love a lot of the European systems where they do things like they will have only public finance. Get X, they get the same amount. And you would get only X amount of time. Like you can run a campaign you can run a campaign for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days, whatever the window is, and that's it. Instead of, you know, 24/7, 365, year after year, you just got to be a multimillionaire to even win a race that we have here. It's insane. And it allows
it is
no,
insane because essentially what's happening is that the networks and the people that own the media, that's generally now owned by corporations, they make a lot of profit. On.
Yep. True.
Go ahead. Ooh, what happened?
Did we lose you, Randy?
Yeah, we lost him.
Okay.
Randy, you need to call back. Well, he can't even hear me.
Yeah. But anyway, his point is valid. Yeah. So you've got a system that has become profitable, and they spend enormous amounts. I mean, last, like, presidential campaign, for instance, was a $1 billion race. And guess what? All those ads and all that make a lot of money.
$1 billion.
A lot of companies. So you can understand why it becomes a perpetuating system. But, again, it disenfranchises the actual people. And normal people can't run in a system like that. Because if you don't have a company backing you, or multimillionaires or whatever, then you can't run.
Yeah.
And so that just cuts out the common person ever being able to participate in the system, which is, of course, their point. Like you said, there's extremists in the conservative movement who want nothing but money to be in. I mean, that's what choice do you have?
Well,
if you got to run a $1 million campaign.
The thing is that, okay, so we keep getting back to this. Anyway,
the points that I got to show you is just how insidious it becomes. My grandparents lived in a little bitty town called Long Beach. Not California, but Long Beach, Mississippi. Itty bitty town. Had one street, you know. Just had one little
street?
Yeah, one street going through town. And then it's got, you know, little, you know.
Did they have
area.
A stop sign?
Yeah, they had several. But it was just a small, sleepy little town. And then when the law changed down there, after the, you know, one of the hurricanes and stuff, they got things opened up so they could have development. They legalized gambling for the first time because it's always been.
Was Christie involved in this?
No.
Okay.
But the churches and all that down there had always forbidden that and blocked it and everything
else. Of course.
But
they go
decided,
to,
hey, you know what? Bingo is
gamble, right?
Everybody should be able to gamble, so you just can't have the bingo parlor, you know. So they legalized it everywhere. Well, when those casinos came in, she was saying, my grandmother was horrified. The mayorship there, the little sleepy mayorship, they paid around something like $16,000, $19,000 for the job, all this stuff. Little bitty job, right? Overnight, the race for mayor and topped over $1 million. Over $1 million.
Wonder why?
These guys that got in spent $1 million to get a $19,000 job. Now, you tell me how that's possible, and it's only because of this unbelievable flood of outside court money. And that's troubling. That right there is the death of democracy. It ends up being, you know, where you're run by
a
flunky.
You know, here's the thing. We keep saying, and the right wing keeps saying, is the death of democracy. Rush Limbaugh, ever since he's been on the air, every year, day, he says, this country is finished. This country, Bill Clinton, it is definitely Barack Obama. No. You have a black man in my house. Forget it. It's done. But, you know, it ain't never done.
Right.
We are not like these countries that have three and four parties and five parties running, and they change governments every 6 months, like Israel. No government that's had more than one party has lasted as long as we have. Now, one problem is, the reason why is why we have 435 people in the House and 100 people in the Senate, and why you break different parts of each one of those bodies into committees. Because if everybody voted on every single thing to accept it or not accept it, they wouldn't vote on nothing. But they do that in the House right now. So the thing is, they vote, but they know it's not going to compete. But that's why they vote for against Obamacare 40 times.
Yeah.
But the problem is, you can't have more than two organizations that are actually running against each other. I was talking to somebody here, you know him, Lee Little. Lee says, I'm going to be an independent and I want. I said, look, that's a bunch of fracking stuff. Because there's no such thing as someone who is independent and sits on a fence. No such thing. It sounds nice. It sounds like that you're knowledgeable. It sounds like that you, I know what I'm doing. Bullshit! It's wrong. It don't happen.
Are you saying rebel without a cause?
Rebel without a cause. It does not happen. There is no such thing as a person who sits on the fence. Let's see, we got our chairman back. We got you ready. We got you back. Oh, who's that?
Yes, I'm right here.
Gotcha. Okay. That's all right.
On the battery died.
But yeah, we were just having a talk about the
nature of democracy
the point of having independent candidate. That is garbage. Nobody is sitting on the fence and saying, I'm independent, I don't like this and I don't like that. There, you got to take a stand. You have to take a stand. It is always going to be, what do you like this person better than you like the other person? It's always going to be like that. Every country that we have seen that has more than one party don't last. None of these countries has lasted as long as we have. What do you think about that, Mr. Chairman?
I agree with you. The notion that there are actually, quote, truly independent people is just simply not true. And we all know from science, once you observe or you are observed, it changes the nature of it. Nothing exists in a vacuum. So, I mean, people who label themselves as unaffiliated voters, they lean a certain direction or they have issues that they believe in. And a lot of times you find if you talk to them, they either have a mistrust of political parties or they have not been involved with parties, whether they be Libertarian, Republican, Democrat, Green, Socialist, Democrat, Socialist, whatever you want to throw in there. Do you have values that they believe in? So I was interviewed the other day by a more conservative radio station, and they were asking me about conservatives versus liberals, and I said, look, I don't really ascribe to the labeling. I just said, look at the politician or the leader and look what the actions that they've done. That will tell you who they are, regardless of what they say they are. There are plenty right. of, quote, conservative Republicans that are not very conservative at all in their actions, in the classical sense of the word.
Right. Well, what do you expect to come out of this SEC meeting tomorrow?
Well, I think that people are going to come together. We'll go through our normal agenda. We'll discuss, organizing for precincts and getting energy going into the spring and talk about how we're going to invest in our county parties, what we're going to do to build up our operations around the state so that we can actually begin taking back the General Assembly district by district in this election cycle and the next.
Well, what do you tell people that say, you know, I'm trying to organize this precinct. I tried every 2 years, like I try to organize the precincts, and nobody wants to be part of.
Nobody wants to be part of the party.
No, nobody wants to be part of being involved in a precinct organization.
Well, I tell people you have to get outside your comfort zone, find other ways to reach people, you know, whether that's through music, like, you know, I play music, whether that's through other social endeavors. And, you know, if it's not organized in the classical sense, you know, according to our plan of organization as an organized precinct, at least know who we need to get to in these neighborhoods, in these areas, to get out our vote and get our message out. You know, this has been an ongoing trend. If you've read the book Bowling Alone or other studies, you know, we're becoming more factionalized. The people are not participating like they used to do in the organizations that they did back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And the technology allows folks to essentially live these lives on cyberspace, which allows us to communicate a lot, but in some ways, it doesn't allow you to connect as much in a human way. And so, I'm big on having face-to-face interactions. I mean, I love cyberspace, but it's no substitute for actually meeting Michael Lawson and us having a discussion and getting a sense of who we are.
Well, nothing in life beats meeting Michael Lawson. I'm just saying.
No. But Michael, you know what I'm talking about.
Only be had in person.
Okay. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, we have with us, joining us, the 8th District Chair for the Democratic Party, Dr. Galloway, and her husband, Joe Galloway.
Welcome. Hi, it's great to have him on the air.
Nice to be with you.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Michael.
Hi. How you doing? Grace, do you have anything to ask the chairman while he's on the line here?
No, I Randy knows I send him emails consistently anytime I have a question, so I'm good. Or I text him or something. I'll call him.
look,
Grace is a strong Democrat, and she's not shy about telling someone why she feels the way she does. If we had more Grace Galloways, we'd have a better state, and more Joe Galloways.
Thank you.
Joe, do you have anything you want to ask the chairman while we have more?
Oh, I just hope he's working hard, getting everybody in line for the election this year. A lot of people need to turn out and change a few things in North Carolina.
A few things. I like that.
Mr. Chairman, how can we get in touch, send some money into the Democratic Party? How can we get in touch with you?
How can we get? How do we get in touch with me or send money to the party? Is this two separate questions?
Both. Yep. Both. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you can go directly online at ncdp.org and contribute there. I'm actually working on getting two new websites up that's going to help us collect money that we can distribute to the districts. Obviously, Grace is a congressional district chair that we would be able to split funds between the district and the state and put more money locally. And if you need to get in touch with me, just email me at ncdemchair@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to get back in touch with you. I also have a Facebook account, NCDP Chair, to look up Randy Voller, and you can find me.
Well, that's wonderful.
I just wanted to say we've got a show about the rise of the super wealthy.
You're breaking up.
Or like the Jews in the Holocaust, you know, the 1% being attacked by the 99. And the children and their food thrown in the garbage can, their parents are over here on the, you know, account at school. What are we doing? Because one of the troubling things we talked about with the judge earlier on the Supreme Court was the change in financing here where they don't have public these funds year-round to pay for campaigns. But with this rise of the poor victim, 1% rich, what are we doing in North Carolina to counter that and to, you know, reinvigorate the electorate? Because part of the reason we have low turnout is people are giving up, and they seem like they're no choice, no chance, and they don't want to participate. I talk to people all the time who are disillusioned. There's no chance.
Well,
so what do we?
I think that that's a very complicated question, and certainly the Republicans at a certain level have created their strategy is to make government not work, to make people get angry with government. So you'll see, McCrory's decision-making in this state shows that DHHS and now with food stamps, they're incompetent. But ultimately, people don't say, oh, the Democrats warned you about that. No, they just say government doesn't work. And the more that you depress people's hope, the more it works for the GOP because they don't want people engaged in democracy unless they're folks that are going to vote for them. And they don't want to expand the voter universe because obviously, the more people who are engaged and the more people understand what's going on from a local to regional to state to federal level, the harder it is for them to put forth policies that benefit the 0.1% or the 1%. I think clearly it's incumbent on me and other leaders in the party to communicate that we have a problem with wealth and income inequality, for instance. This problem didn't just start with Obama, as I've heard some right-wingers say. The problem started with philosophical choices that came forth in the 1970s, and specifically when Ronald Reagan was elected, were allowed to flower and bloom. And we've got to show it and say it and stand by it. You know, ultimately, the hope is lost when people feel that, you know, the corporatocracy is running this country, and it's a left wing and a right wing, and only a few people are in that plane. Now, I'm not in that plane. I'm not riding in that plane. But I know that I know that people feel that politics only benefits a certain group, and it's our job to show them that no. And local politics is where it starts. That's where you can actually show a difference. You know, you can get, for instance, as a mayor of my town, when I came into office, our water quality that was being supplied to the citizens was substandard. When I left, we're producing some of the best water in the entire Piedmont. That was a choice we made. And that was involving direct democracy.
Well, I know sweeping the president and ready for this convention. So I want to take time in being with us, Mr. Chairman. And I will see you tomorrow for an interview for our show for Friday next week.
I'll see you tomorrow, Michael. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. That was the report. Randy Voller. Nice thing to say about But right
did you put
now,
his back on yet, Michael?
What's that?
Did you put his back on?
Back on. Oh.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Well, listen, you need to ask Joe all the questions you want to ask him.
I was about to say, I don't want to talk to you yet. I want to talk to Joe.
Okay. I'm shutting up right now. I'm shutting up.
Right.
I didn't say a word. I'm shutting up.
Joe, it is so good to get, you know, I got, I don't know the tough questions or what kind of questions, but you are the man that knows. I mean,
well,
after all your years.
Awards.
We don't have the time to read all his awards. I mean, he has everything but the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Including the Bronze Star.
Well, so, I mean, you know, he's not someone that walks around with his Bronze Star on his sleeve like some of the Republicans do. By the way, they don't have Bronze Stars. I forgot. That's true.
The pretend Bronze Stars.
He is one of the most famous, not infamous, famous correspondents and newspaper men ever in this country. He's wrote and worked for consultant and McCloskey newspapers and during the Vietnam War. He worked alongside the troops in the trenches. Too bad we can't say that. No,
you're going to embarrass me, Michael.
We can't say that about McConnell. We can't say that about Rand Paul or Ron Paul.
Yeah.
We can't say that up.
Those guys are all chicken hawks.
Yeah, they are. They are, truly.
They're ready to vote to send other people's kids off to die in wars, but not their own and not themselves.
Yes. Absolutely correct. And why I have you here, speaking about war, what do you think about the president's withdrawal of the troops from Afghanistan?
Wonderful. It's just late, 5 years late.
Well, you see, would have or could he have done this sooner?
Oh, he could have done it sooner when he first came into office on a pledge to do just that. I mean, he fulfilled the pledge on Iraq, but he stuck with Afghanistan long enough for it to become his war instead of Bush's war.
Well,
and I just think he should have got out quicker.
But wouldn't he have had a revolt with the generals, even though the civilian runs the military? The last time that happened, the president was assassinated.
Well.
Yeah, well. I don't think the generals had anything to do with that assassination any other.
No, it wasn't them. It was the people that make the bullets.
The money maker.
That had something to do with it.
Well, I think it had everything to do with the economy, to be honest, Mike. The reason I think he had to drag his feet on that is because our economy is basically 60% of the military's our economy. So if we would have pulled out unilaterally out of both of those wars instantly, because you remember when he went in, we were at the depths of the Great Recession.
Right.
It would have devastated the economy, and that was one, at least, source of income, to be blunt.
Right.
These guys were all employed over there shooting people and blowing things up, but it was...
We're past that now.
We're past that now. No, you're absolutely true, but...
But I think that's why...
I don't want to hear them talking about leaving 10,000 Americans there either. Not in a country which is bleeding us dry of $1 trillion that, is just disappearing into Swiss bank accounts. They're turning around and shooting, our allies are shooting us in the back. And we want to leave them 10,000 more targets? No.
Okay,
we get out.
But why are the generals saying, like, McChrystal, who isn't there anymore, and these other people saying, we can't leave,
Well, that's, McChrystal doesn't have a damn thing to say about it. He's done and finished and fired. And the only thing about him I got to say is he should have been fired a lot earlier because he was up to his ears in the cover-up over the killing of that young Ranger officer, the NFL football player.
Tillman.
Well, you know who signed his bogus Silver Star Award was Dan McChrystal.
Oh, McChrystal.
And if I were president, I would have fired him for that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a cover. Well, the family is still suing. Aren't they suing over that? They're still suing over that, aren't they?
I don't know. If I were the family, I would still be furious.
Yeah, well, they're suing over it. They wanting to get you know, freedom of information on the incident. But one of the other things I wanted to ask.
Well, let me just ask this real quick because Joe would know. He understands geopolitics. But one of the quote unquote reasons I've read about that we are there and want to stay there is because we want a central Eurasian military base, a power structure on the border of China because of what's going on. That's why we're there. That's all I've heard.
So that pipeline?
Yeah, and of course, that to me is a side issue, the economics of putting the oil pipelines through and all that. That was all more, you know, Cheney and his, you know, oil baronry. But the control of the resources, that is viable, but also geopolitically to put something right there between Russia and China, but especially against China's western flank. That's very important. That's why we built those bases.
Yeah, but this is, you know, that's the last place in the world you want to build a permanent base and permanently occupy it because those folks, for 4,000 years, they've been fighting invaders, and when there aren't any invaders, they fight each other.
Right.
This is not any place to have to get into geopolitical strategies. Those folks live somewhere in about the 14th century. They're not a country. They're tribes with flags.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's like the Hatfield and McCoys of the Appalachia.
Worse.
Another thing, Joe. What do you think about the president choosing to negotiate with the Iranians instead of reaching up and putting more sanctions?
Well, you know, I'm going to quote you, Winston Churchill. It's better to jaw, jaw, jaw than fight, fight, fight. And all I got to say is all you have to hear is Dick Cheney saying we ought to be going after Iran militarily to understand that that's the last thing you want to do. Negotiations are good as long as you get something out of them. Keep talking. I have to cheer the president and Mr. Kerry for what they did, not only there but in Syria. Although Syria looks like coming unglued, at least there are no American troops on the ground in there.
Well, that, you know, if it was up to Arizona, we would have been in there and had
you don't take advice on geopolitical matters from John McCain or little Lindsey Graham from South Carolina or any of those guys.
Well, here's a question. Here's a question on the because I heard this against our president lately. Somebody was talking about it in the context of Syria, but they were talking about, if you will, a failure to completely capitalize on or realize the dream of, or however you want to say it, but they were blaming him on somehow the missed opportunity of the Arab Spring, how, you know, Egypt has come unraveled and all these different
countries. You know, there's Egypt and Syria are two different animals. That argument, that criticism makes no sense to me.
No, it was just the criticism that Obama somehow didn't do enough to sustain the Arab Spring or support it or whatever, and now it's all falling apart across all of North Africa.
You know, that's bogus argument. There's nothing we can do to influence the Arab Spring. If we support it, that's enough to turn most of the Arab world against it.
That's real policy, I think.
Well, since I need to find out what you thought about that, and we're having a problem now. Now, one other thing, I get a hold of your other half there is, what do you think about the spying in of with Germany? And we looked through the files. Heard what was going on.
Talking about Snowden.
You know, gentlemen do read other gentlemen's mail, and we always have, and they try their best to read our mail. Everybody is spying on everybody, and you know, we don't listen to criticism for doing what everybody else is doing as well.
Absolutely. That's what I think. The people who are the low information voters are the ones that don't understand. Because if you don't know, what's this, Michael, on polio saying, keep your friends close but your enemies closer? You got to do that. Because we're not playing with sticks and stones anymore. Well, I need to now ask your other half there a couple of questions before we...
All right, I'm going to turn you over to her.
Okay.
Take care, Michael.
All right, Joe. Thank you. Well?
Hey.
This
the doctor.
Raceline Galloway doctor. What do you think about Hagen? Does she have enough to win North Carolina? Hello? Well, I missed you. Okay. I'm sorry.
Thank you. There you go. You muted me, dude.
Yeah. I muted the wrong movie. I muted.
You muted me.
Wrong person.
Well, speaking of Senator Hagen, first of all, she is absolutely one of my most favorite people in the whole wide world. And I think she will, you know, she's not as progressive as I would like her to be, but the bottom line is that when push comes to shove and the important votes, she votes for the people. Okay.
Right.
So as much as I get, I think she has a very good chance. In fact, I know she has a very good chance. I know that she's going to take North Carolina. The choices that we have, never mind, you know, the fact of all, let's just look at her record, okay? Her record, she's voted consistently to help North Carolinians. She's voted consistently. She voted for health care. She's done everything that she can to make sure that the military in North Carolina are taken care of. She worked against closing of the bases. She worked towards the investigation of the water at Camp Lejeune. She signed on. She really has pushed the most important issues, the issues that I feel are so important to North Carolinians. Number one, of course, the military, because we are a big military state. The second, the kids. the kids in North Carolina, she absolutely stood up and said, you know, she has always worked for the children. When these idiots up in Raleigh decided they were going to cut food stamps and all that kind of, she made it very well, very plain and very clear how appalled she was at this at their move. I mean, she can't do anything about North, about what Raleigh does, because that's Raleigh. It's a state government state. But she is not shy about making her, her intentions and her feelings known. You know, she's done really, really well. Plus, she is one of the biggest people in support of women's rights. She has... supported the Lilly Ledbetter Act. She is one of, if not, I think she's all the Democrats are. All the Democrats are on board with raising the minimum wage. And I think just based on that argument alone, she can win. Just the minimum wage alone, she can win. Because none of the Republicans want minimum wage increase.
Of course, but you took one of my questions off my page here. Is why do women in North Carolina vote against their own self-interest?
Well, the women that do vote against their own self-interest do so because they are the uninformed or the miserably informed. Okay, and so it is our job as women to reach out to other women and inform them. Women will listen to women before they will listen to men, unless, of course, they are completely abused and subjugated by a guy. Which is possible. I mean, there are women that are self-haters. You know, they loathe themselves. And so they get themselves into situations that are not healthy. But there again, that's a minority. We, you know, because we've learned women throughout the years, we've learned that we have to stand up for ourselves, and we have to, if we don't fight for ourselves, nobody else will. And we have managed to forge. Go ahead.
See, you beg the question, because we would not have had all these morons, Raleigh, in office if women would have voted.
That's true. That's true. If women had, but then you're talking about if all women voted the same way. If all women voted the same way, we would have whomever it is that we want in office. Yes.
Yeah.
If you just take nurses alone, if all nurses in the United States voted the same way, we could pick our president.
Well,
okay, we could pick our president.
But you see,
unfortunately, you don't all vote the same way.
But you should get 60%. I mean,
yeah.
Why would a woman vote against being able to take a contraceptive aid? This makes no sense to me.
It doesn't. It makes no sense to me either. But I put it in this context, okay? The women who vote against their, quote, self-best interests are voting against they're one-note samba, okay? They're voting against or for one issue. They're a single-issue person. So this is where the Republicans are very smart. This is where the Republicans have managed to convince that group of uninformed or low-informed, miserably informed people that abortion is the critical issue. They don't teach them, they don't tell them that, no, it's not just abortion. It's your own reproductive rights. It's birth control. It's, you know, it's so many other things. It's mammograms, pap smears. It's all the stuff that you get for free. They don't do that. They conveniently don't tell them that. They couch everything on that one focus issue, that one issue, which is abortion. And so women who are lowly informed or miserably informed, or uninformed, don't realize that. That's where I say it is up to us as women, and I'm saying this now, I hope every single female within earshot of my voice right now would take it upon themselves to purposely seek out, engage, and engage every woman that they know to inform them of what they are voting for, okay, and what they are voting against. Abortion has absolutely no place at all on the ballot. None. Period. None. Okay? Religion has no place on the ballot. None. Again, issues like economy, separating church and state, issues of foreign policy, issues of whether children go to bed hungry at night, issues about whether veterans are sleeping under a bridge. You know, they came home after serving their country, and there's no job for them except flipping burgers, and they're expected to support their families based upon $7.25 an hour. Those are the issues they need to be focusing on. So, again, it's up to us. I challenge every woman who's listening to me to do that.
It's voting against their own self-interest. Isn't that like the film Usual Suspects, where they say that the greatest trick in the world is the devil does is to convince you that he doesn't exist? Well, this is the same thing.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Oh, yes.
You're not going to get pregnant. You're not going to get pregnant. Yes. Just hold ass between your legs. Don't worry. You're not going to get pregnant because you have that that you can kill.
Magical ability. Yeah, that magical ability to stop yourself from getting pregnant. Yeah.
Then
yeah.
How do intelligent women still vote that way?
Well, the good news, that's mind-boggling to me, too. And see, that's the thing. Intelligent women don't. Intelligent women don't vote that way. That's the thing. Okay? And the good news is that even the uninformed and the lesser informed women, I can't call them intelligent or stupid or whatever, the lesser informed women are beginning to wake up. Because they're realizing when this fool gets on national TV and says, oh, the old-fashioned way, put an aspirin between your knees. Really, how insulting can you be? How insulting, you know?
Well, because women in government speak out and say, what the heck is going on here? Who is this masked man that could say something
like that? Who is this moron? He's a moron.
Republican woman stood up and...
Yeah, well, you know, we've got people like Renee Elmers who stand up there and go, oh, yeah, what a girl, that is so clever. Yes, of course, Athens. I mean, you know, we've got idiots like Renee Elmers who ran and won and now are in Congress and who still don't know what they're saying, their left hand from their right hand, who still don't understand that what they're doing is voting against women's rights. She doesn't get it. She doesn't get it. Poor people. Well, who cares if they don't have their money? Who cares if they don't, as long as she gets? Remember, she's the one who said during the sequester that when she was asked to give up her paycheck, she says, oh, no, I need my money.
Yeah, well, you're just like a fox in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And like we were talking about before you came on, the Tom Perkins, the venture capitalist, who said, why are they always picking on us, billionaires? Well, you know, I mean, you know, well, why do they want to pick on us? You know, this is completely, well, I want to thank you because I know you're running. Are you going to be here tomorrow?
I am. I will be. I'll see you, Michael.
I'm going to interview you and see, Joe knows when not to come to these places. He knows.
You know.
Have a... And forget about this nonsense, but
what can I tell you? What can I tell you? You're right.
He's a Bronze Star, but there ain't no Bronze Star in this year. Everybody dies in this meeting.
Yeah. All right, Michael, I will see you tomorrow, my love.
I will see you. I'll get some more information from you, another interview, and see what's going on, tell you how you like the meeting and whatnot. I want to thank you very much. And that is our doctor in the house, and none other than Grace Lean Galloway, our doctor in the house. I want to thank you,
Michael.
Grace.
Okay. See you tomorrow.
Bye.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Man, woman. Earth, death, infinity.
Yes, that was the opening theme of the great show, Ben Casey. But I need everybody just just to do a little listening now that we are. The Academy Awards is coming up.
Dun, da, da.
And so is the Super Bowl.
Ooh.
Next week. The Super Bowl is coming up next week. And a funny thing happened, was it a week ago?
The NFL discovered that there's winter?
No, but they discovered that there's a man out there who can definitely play. Who can definitely play the cornerback. He can definitely play cornerback. But the people started screaming about thuggery. And that's a major problem. Thuggery. Let's just listen to a little bit of something here that I had put together, a little collage of something from people who I think it's very important. Just listen to a little bit of this from our I'm trying to remember where it is at, but it must be around here somewhere. I know I had it. Oh yeah, there it is. This is the collage we put together for your enlistment. For your listening. Thank you.
And listen.
All right, Richard, let me ask you the final play.
That was not what I wanted to hear. Now that sounds like
that
just a bunch
that
of
was the
stuff
first
out
test.
There.
Were you really
that was
listening?
The first test. Were you really listening? No, you weren't really listening. And where am I at? Oh, come on. Not Mitch McConnell. Oh, okay. Yes, here it is. Right here. Just listen.
You own or you control two major hotels in Vegas.
No. I'm sorry. Here it is. I swear this time.
Ask me about my affairs.
Joe, back over to you.
All right, well, same note, with Grimm physically threatening Michael. We're going to show you how the interview ended.
And just finally, before we let you go, since we have you here, we haven't had a chance to kind of talk about some of that.
Not think about anything that's off topic. This is only about the president.
Well, what about... All right, so Congressman Michael Grimm does not want to talk about some of the allegations concerning his campaign finances. We wanted to get him on camera on that, but he, as you saw, refused to talk about that. Back to you.
Yes.
You're not a man enough. You're not a man enough. I'll break you in two, you little boy.
What a thuggish thing to say.
Now, we have with us...
But he has a suit and tie. That makes it okay.
Mr. George Gaffney, entrepreneur, film critic, athlete, all-around gentleman. Who is the thug? Was it Michael Corleone, who just got to killing his son-in-law? Was it Richard Sherman, who just saved his team the game and brought them to the Super Bowl? Or was it Representative Michael Grimm, who helped, who said that he would throw this reporter over the balcony and break him in half like a little boy? What do you think, Mr. Gaff?
This is all beyond me. I stick to the movies. I'm not into the, don't get me into the world of politics and crime and all this, the real world. I'm hiding the nether world of film.
Well, I
I'm
mean,
not the one to ask.
Taking it to the part where they take Richard Sherman, who is a Stanford graduate, who just got through saving his team, another chance to get the Super Bowl trophy, and compare them to two guys, one who threatened somebody on TV and the other one who just did something in the movies, which was not real at all. I would think that thuggery falls on Michael Corleone and Michael Griffin and not an athlete who just played his heart out for 60 minutes. Or, matter of fact, 3 hours. So that's the connection I was trying to make. They say that life imitates art, but I don't know, unless it was the mafia or the bookies down in Vegas that had San Francisco as the winners, that would actually do something like this. So that's what I was trying to get across in this short little episode, since we have the Super Bowl coming up next week. But as
next
you said,
week, tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday.
No, Sunday. Yeah, well, Monday
is
the start.
Tuesday.
Well, all right, so we'll move on. What is the best picture? And I mistakenly told you that Captain Phillips wasn't nominated. It is nominated.
Yeah, I know. I caught that. Tom Cruise, Tom Hanks wasn't nominated. That's why.
Right. That's
why
that is, so.
You got that misunderstanding. Somebody, you were thinking in terms of somebody said Captain
right.
Phillips was not nominated, meaning the role,
right.
not the. But
right.
Captain that's, Phillips is. I haven't seen all these pictures. I've only seen Gravity and Captain Phillips, but I don't know how anything could be much better than Captain Phillips. But you know. I don't really, I'm telling you now, I wouldn't go to sleep before I knew who won the Academy Award. I mean, when I was very young, I would stay up, and I had to know who won before I'd go to sleep. And it kept getting later and later as the years progressed. The announcement would come later and later in the day or later and later in the night. and I would stay up. I had to know. But
yes.
Now I could be – last year, I knew Argo won because I predicted Argo the day I saw it. But excuse me. But I don't know how he can really be much better than Captain Phillips. But, you know, the way people vote is first of all, like I always say, when you make a movie like Titanic, you've got a good chance of winning the Academy Awards. You got like 5,000 people involved in this movie. You got the cast. You got all the costumes that were made. You got all the technical equipment that had to be used. You've got all the sets and locations. And all these people vote. These are SAG members and things like that that get the vote, union people who get the vote in the Academy Award process. And if you employed all these people for over a year to make the Titanic or something like that, you got a good chance of winning. You know,
yeah,
it's not the theater goers that vote; it's the members of the unions and things. And the other thing is, if you have a movie, in other words, like I said, if, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? You got four people in the picture.
That's right.
So
right.
you got four people in the picture. They're always on a sound stage. You got
and
a crew of maybe 20
and
people.
Three of them were nominated for Academy Awards. Three out of the four were nominated. And Fanny Dennis did win it. And Liz Taylor won it. So you're saying, well, realistically, we got American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity, Nebraska, Philomena, and 12 Years a Slave, and Wolf of Wall Street. Now,
Wolf of Wall Street, I haven't seen it because I just don't believe that a picture that's 3 hours in that with that plot and stuff could work. I just can't believe it. I'd wait for television because it's just 3 hours to it's like a caper movie or something. I don't see where it could go 3 hours. Now, when they did Lincoln with Daniel Day-Lewis, Lincoln could have gone on forever. I was so interested in Lincoln. They could have had another hour. It wouldn't have bothered me. And it was already like 2 hours and 20 minutes, but it could have gone another hour. I just loved Lincoln, and everything was so informative and revealing and just wonderful. But I don't see how this Wolf of Wall Street, I don't see where you can get 3 hours out of that. So that's one of my things. If I look at the length of a picture, the more weird your plot is, the shorter your picture should be. If you got one of these weird plots like Al Pacino made that movie 88 Minutes or something where he's in the phone booth and he's talking to the killer or I don't know, whatever it was. I never saw the whole thing. But you can't have these weird plots and keep the people in the movie too long because then they start to figure out what's wrong. There's something wrong with these weird plots, and you want to get the picture over with before they can start to ask too many questions.
Speaking about weird plots, and about a three-hour movie, I should say. I mean, to me, there is, I told you before, to me, and my greatest films, there's four, and two of them are The Godfather, and then there's Citizen Kane and The Casablanca. And there is, as I told you before, in The Godfather, there isn't one single character in The Godfather that you don't remember. That's how
Godfather is great. I mean, you could go on and it had a story that was rich. I mean, the story could sustain itself for, you know, they could have put two more hours on each of the pictures. It would have been fine. Now, Godfather 3 is not even in the running. That's not even considered a Godfather by me.
I didn't mention Godfather 3. That's why I said
no, nobody could mention it. Nobody could mention it. It was a cartoon. But the first
absolutely
two pictures are all-time classics. I mean, there's no argument. Sometimes when you say that, you think that that's one of the top pictures or something. You're saying it like you're not – like you expect an argument. That's
right.
You can put The Godfather, both of them, as one and two of all time. I mean, that's fine.
Oh, absolutely.
But that three is just – I mean, I hate that they shouldn't have never allowed that to be called three. That was – terrible picture.
B. But anyway, but the thing is that the thing we say about the in the Godfather is that you feel like you are a part of their family, and everything that's going on is hurting you. They made you. That was the start. It really was a feed off of the anti-hero films, you know, spaghetti western types where the hero was a killer, but you were always worried about him dying, and then that came in with The Godfather. You cheered for every single one of those people in the Corleone family, even the fool sister that kept crying and crying and crying and getting beat up and beat up and beat up. I mean, you cheered for Sonny when he kicked the heck out of that horrible brother-in-law of his. I mean, and you loved the portion where the concierge went to the prison and told the Corleone captains that he was in prison. Hey, look, you know you got to do what they did in the old days, and don't worry, we'll take care of your family because you can't testify. I mean, you were involved with that, and you hated these other guys. You hated the guys that killed Luca Brasi. I mean, you know, he's sleeping with the fishes. You didn't like them guys. You were waiting for them to get their end. And when Don Corleone told them anything should happen to my son Michael when he comes back here, I remember you. I remember all you. So, B, you remember lines. I mean, you can't remember any lines from any of these other films that won Academy Awards. You can't remember any lines.
Yeah, they're not memorable like that. That just, you know, you're right. I mean, they're not that kind of pitches. What you remember sometimes, like, for instance, at Argo. Argo, as soon as I saw it, I said it's going to win the Academy Award because here's what Argo had. Argo, it wasn't like any great lines or anything like that, but what happened was you knew that these people were going to escape, and yet the pitch ahead, you worried about them. You knew they were going to escape. I mean, it's a historic picture. And yet I worried about them getting through customs. I worried about them when they were on the plane. I worried about them being found out at the Canadian embassy. It was just they had you worried about something that you knew how it turned out. That was a tribute to that picture. And I said that's what they created tension where there shouldn't have been any tension. You should have laid back and relaxed and said, "Oh, this all turned out okay." It didn't. Because they made it so, they showed how every step the people had to make personal decisions, you know, about whether they would go forward, whether they would do this and that. And that, it was just amazing to have tension in a picture where you knew the outcome, you know. So it was a different thing, but you can't, for dialogue and relationships, you can't beat The Godfather. It's just tremendous that, like you said, all those personal relationships were just, was a story in themselves. Every personal relationship in that picture was a old little mini plot.
Right. Well, what do you think about the best actor? Have you a chance to look at them?
Tom Cruise, I mean, you can't, I don't see how you can beat Tom Cruise in Captain Phillips. What helped Tom Hanks in Captain Phillips was he was the only actor in the whole story that was known. There was nobody in that picture that you could say who they were. Nobody had any name. I mean, these guys hadn't even been seen in a commercial or anything. They were all new, and all the Somali pirates were non-actors. They were guys who they put in the paper, and they interviewed like 1,000 people to get these 5 or 6 guys who were going to play the Somali pirates. And the picture was great. I didn't see most of the pictures. I only saw 2 of the nominated pictures. But Captain Phillips had you rooting. You were rooting for Captain Phillips and the people on the ship, but you were also rooting for the pirates because they made the stories so that you could realize the pirates were under duress for their family and themselves to come back with money. The pirates couldn't make a deal and couldn't get out of what they were into because they were under duress from people higher up. So you were sympathetic to the pirates. Now, that's amazing that you're sympathetic to the crew being kidnapped and yet you're sympathetic to the pirates because you realize that they're victims too. That was a wonderful thing. I mean, I can't see how anything could have beat Captain Phillips. But, again, people vote for different things.
Well, the best picture of the world, we got American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity, Her, where he talks to his TPA.
Yeah.
Nebraska.
The only one I saw was Captain Phillips and Gravity. Now, Gravity has a plot that is an award-winning plot because you cannot help but care about Sandra Bullock. There's only two people in the story, Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. They're the only two people. There's one guy who's in a spacesuit who's in the picture for 90 seconds. That's it. You never see another person. Never. There's no other person in the story except Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. And so what happens is it's them against the elements. Now, I don't think you're going to root for space. I don't think you're going to root for, that space kills them. You want these people to survive because you've got to identify with them. They're only two people in the story. You can't help but identify with them. You can't help but root for them. There's no other team. It's just those two people. And you have to root for them against the elements because see yourself as in their shoes. They have to survive all these different things, running short of air, being sucked into a void, starving to death. You have to root for them, and that's what made that so strong. So it's not like a Star Wars picture where you had all this magical equipment and talking robots, but it was the idea of it's two human beings against nature. You got to root for the human beings, kid.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I wanted to burn to death in the rays of the sun or something. That's not going to happen. So that was a strong point in that.
The best actress, we have Amy Adams, American Hustle, Kate Blanchett for Blue Jasmine, Sandra Bullock, Gravity, Judi Dench, Philomena, and Meryl Streep, again, as August Orange County.
Yeah.
Now,
well, again, I didn't see the pictures, but except I would say this. Sandra Bullock had to carry her picture by herself because she was on that screen. She was on that screen like 60% of the time. George Clooney was only in there 30 to 40% of the time. She carried that picture by herself, and therefore, I don't know what the other women did. I didn't see the picture. But I'm saying Sandra Bullock had a strong thing. Plus, Sandra Bullock is an old-time person. She's been there forever. You know, she started very young.
Yeah.
And she's been there forever. So, if they have never given her anything before, then this is a chance to give her something. And that counts in Hollywood.
Well, we have just 10 seconds. So you like Sandra Bullock and you like
Tom. I can't like Tom Hanks. He's not nominated.
Captain Phillips.
Yeah, I like Tom. I like Captain Phillips for the pitcher. I like Meryl Streep Sandra Bullock for best actress. What does it have here for actor?
Years
a Slave. Like the star of the pitcher, he didn't have much. He really didn't have much to do. He was a guide. He wasn't as of Randy. Yeah. Randy Parrish said 6 weeks ago, he was a guide. He wasn't the feature of the picture, even though he was a star. He was the lead character. I don't know about that.
We'll see what happens.
Okay.
We'll talk about it again next week. Everybody have a great weekend and enjoy the Super Bowl and don't eat so much. I was going to have some statistics on that. We got over 21,000 hot dogs going to be eaten, 20,000 sausages, 7,500 individual pizzas, 50,000 cups of coffee and chocolate, 30,000 glasses of soda, and 104 million pounds of guacamole. But all that other stuff I mentioned besides the guacamole is going to be eaten at the stadium. Okay, good night. Goodbye, folks. Goodbye.
Super.
behind me. Any emotion on his face.